If you'd like to connect with nature in all its wonder and intricacy, then join our Shady Grove Bush Care volunteers. It's a very healthy exercise. I think we lose contact with soil, and that's part of our problem. Our next Shady Grove Bush Care will be on this coming Wednesday, the 26th. Jenny won't be there, but I'm hoping to get there, and Melissa, our botanist, will be there to give some instruction, mainly to keep an eye on me so that I don't tear out natives rather than weeds, which is always a problem. If you've missed a service, you can log into our web pages at unitariansa.org.au, and you can click on the orange Expanding Horizons button for a sound podcast without the video, which contains edited recordings of most of our services, extending back several years, in fact. My talk today is on regret, and as with all our services, I'll podcast it on Expanding Horizons sometime tonight, following my editing out of such things as any copyrighted music, stories for all ages that may be copyrighted, unless they're our own stories, and of course Candles for Joy and Concern. We don't put them up on the web either.
Listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Lighting our chalice this morning, let its flame be a symbol of the warmth and light of this beloved community. May it shine a light of understanding, insight, and resolution on our past regrets, but also to light our pathways towards new insights, hope, growth, and renewal in our lives and in the lives of those we love. So let's begin. This is a stained glass window in the Chapel of Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving Square in Dallas, Texas. Its spiral structure has a roof of stained glass and it embraces the Fibonacci sequence of numbers. If you've ever known that, it very commonly appears in things like sunflower seeds and in nature. So it's, to me, an expression of the ways in which religion, science, mathematics, and nature may all combine to reveal a deeper sense of divinity. I'll now ring the bell and it'll be followed by a brief moment of silence. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship. I'm a member of the church, as you know, and I welcome you to our service on behalf of generations of Unitarians from South Australia and from all over the world who've worshipped with us for over 169 years. Just imagine that. I'm filling in today for Chris Hanna, our minister, who commenced leave after his service last Sunday, and Chris will be away until the 2nd of July, after which he will return to us to take up his new position as our settled minister. I acknowledge that the land on which our two churches stand is the traditional land of the Kaurna and the Paramak people. We pay respect to their elders, past and present, and their spiritual relationship with the sacred land we now share and which we hold in trust for future generations of Unitarians. For we are also a spiritual community, a church that supports you in seeking and following your own spiritual path, any path that encourages you to see more clearly, to love more abundantly, and to work towards a better world for all. Please join us after this service for tea, coffee, and conversation. Today's service is all about regret, which can be as gentle as the regret at a passing sunrise in this early morning photo taken in our Mount Lofty ranges, looking over towards the Gawler Plains, which leads us into our first song, Morning Has Broken. It's written by Eleanor Fargeon in 1931 to the Gaelic tune Bunessan. That's named after a small village on the island of Mull, Scotland. Grant will play the introduction, and then please stand if you're able. Another song. We're going to make your work today. So our second song is another favourite of mine, Turn Around. This is a gentle, bittersweet, but triumphant regret when a young child grows up, becomes independent, and strides out on their own. It's from our Green Hymn book. The tune will be familiar to you, and the words will be on the screen. If you like the music, you can look it up. 289. Take it away, Grant.
Where are you going, my little one? Where are you going, my baby, my own? Turn around and you're two. Turn around and you're four. Turn around and you're a young girl going out of the door. Turn around. Turn around, turn around, and you're a young girl going out of my door. Where are you going, my little one, girdles and petticoats, where have you gone? Turn around, and you're tiny, turn around, and you're grown. Turn around and you're a young wife with babes of your own. Turn around, turn around, turn around and you're a young wife with babes of your own.
I'll light the first candle. It's our tradition to share recent events, joys, sorrows, insights, milestones on our spiritual journeys in an open forum of fellowship. It's an act of trust that binds our fellowship more closely together and makes this place truly sacred. So if you've had a recent joy or concern that has been significant on your spiritual journey, you can share it by coming up and lighting a candle and telling us about it. As briefly as possible, and as some things lie too deep for words, you're also welcome to light a candle in silence. So whether you choose to light a candle or not, you can take part in our expanding circle of compassion by listening with an open heart and mind. I now open our worship space for this sacred act that draws us together in our shared humanity. There seem to be no more candles, so I'll light one last candle. That candle is for those joys and sorrows that have been shared with us this morning, as well as those joys and sorrows that remain silent in our hearts, but no less deeply felt. We now come to our reading, and Anne is going to do the honours. She will exercise her Shakespearean acting talent in reading Sonnet 120 by William Shakespeare.
That you were once unkind befriends me now, and for that sorrow which I then did feel, needs must I under my transgression bow, unless my nerves were brass or hammered steel. For if you were by my unkindness shaken, as I by yours, you've passed a hell of time, and I, a tyrant, have no leisure taken to weigh how once I suffered in your crime. Oh, that our night of woe might have remembered my deepest sense, how hard true sorrow hits, and soon to you, as you to me, then tendered the humble salve which wounded bosoms fits. But that your trespass now becomes a fee, mine ransom yours, and yours must ransom me.
Thank you, Anne. Today I'd like to share with you some of my thinking about the emotion we know as regret. Shakespeare's sonnet shows a somewhat darker regret than those gentle regrets that are always daily occurrences. The passing of some pleasure, something that we value. So that's the darker side. I'll limit my topic to those regrets that follow from our commitments, our moral choices, our decisions, rather than those regrets arising from situations over which we've got no control, such as earthquakes, flat tyres, or just plain bad luck. Of course, we may make moral choices that follow upon such events. As Shakespeare observes, regrets are so often shared mutual failings that should or could have been avoided. Of course, not all regrets are necessarily due to our failings. Regrets, as we've seen, can be gentle, fleeting, such as the passing of a momentary pleasure or joy, beauty awakening to all those senses, such as in the songs that we've just sung. Or it may be our temporary departure or separation from those we love. But regret can be less gentle, more insistent, such as Shakespeare's. It may linger as the residue of a mutual failing. In his lament, the sense of loss of what once was or might have been, love or trust or both, lost, and perhaps irretrievably. I'm limiting myself today to talking about the phenomenon of regret, the negative bit, the bit that lingers on. Time prevents me from talking about how we might manage our regrets. That's perhaps the harder task, but I'll save that for another time. And as Anzac Day looms, I'll include some regrets about war, whose pendulum seems to swing more rapidly than once in every generation, at the waste of young lives and all their potential. So what is this emotion regret all about? It's so often about the emotional residue left over following a troubling event. What happened when we didn't want it to? Or was it what didn't happen when we wanted it to? The seeds of which may so often be sown in the positives of love or success or both, and much more. The English etymologist and linguist John Rupert Frith, who I seem to quote every time I give an address, said that we know the meaning of words by the company they keep. In attempting to understand an emotion like regret, I tried to create the fullest possible spectrum of understanding around its etymology. And to do that, I search for synonyms, words with similar meaning, but I also search for words at the opposite end of its spectrum of meaning. Now, words antonyms. Isn't it so that the meaning of a word is defined, at least in part, by its opposites, its antonyms? And there's rarely only one. To understand regret, we need to explore what I call the cognitive spectrum of understanding that surrounds it. We really only come to fully know a word by contemplating and playing with its opposites, its antonyms. There's rarely just one word that describes an emotion like regret or that encapsulates its exact opposite. But here are some. Antonyms: delight, satisfaction, happiness, joy, praise, approval, etc. The list could go on. I'd like to add hope to the family of antonyms for regret. In this cartoon, the hope that we can together find a way to heal the wounds of our regrets. And this is why that spectrum of meaning is so important to our understanding of an emotion like regret. That we have once loved is the reason for our mutual regret, Shakespeare seems to be saying. How hard true sorrow hits, and soon to you, as you to me then tended, the humble salve which wounded bosom fits. Our failure to do so will leave a lingering cost to us both, a fee. Mine ransoms yours, and yours must ransom me. So why has regret evolved in us and other sentient animals, ranging from the merest hint of it in a dismissive shrug or a grimace, or at a much deeper level, it may weigh us down with the residue of worry, shame, guilt, failure, even despair. Well, we only have this residue of regret because of these positive opposites at the other end of the joy-regret spectrum. Regret is shared with perhaps all other intelligent, sentient beings. It's not wholly a human emotion. A predator's regret at the escape of a prey, or a somewhat momentary regret of a prey ending up as a meal for one of its predators. This apex predator's regret is only triggered by the delicious memories of all the successful kills that led him to be the big beastie that he is. This one got away, though. I've seen regret in all the dogs that have been part of my life, all with a conscience, all capable of looking and feeling guilty, which I'm sometimes disingenuous enough to be able to disguise, except perhaps from my dogs. On what do we base our regrets? The really negative ones of the sonnet, I mean. That human emotion is based on an unfortunate or unintended consequence or outcome. In the Shakespearean sonnet that Anne read, "For if you were by my unkindness shaken, as I by yours, you've passed a hell of time." And regret, as in Shakespeare's sonnet 120, read by Anne, is so often mutual, the sad residue of a mutual failure that could have been avoided with greater insight, better communication, understanding, and forgiveness. Regrets follow hard upon our acts of commission, the things we've done that we later regret, or our acts of omission, the things we didn't do, our failure to act when we should have acted, the courage, for instance, to speak up when we needed to, instead of remaining silent, holding back when we should have stepped forward and acted. Regret is the residue left when we imagine what might have been had things turned out better, as in the sonnet, unless there is understanding, forgiveness, reconciliation, redemption, your trespass now becomes a fee. Mine ransoms yours, and yours must ransom me. Regret has been a great motivator of religious and moral thinking and reform. Let's imagine we can go back to prehistory. Regret in the eons that preceded formalized religion was an atavistic, primitive emotion to which civilization has since given a religious, moral framework. Any regret still has this residual atavistic element to it. I surmise that regret in its purely atavistic or primitive form flourished for most of human prehistory, extending back to when our hominid ancestors first began to live together cooperatively in extended families, communities, tribes, and nations. It then became necessary for us Homo sapiens to develop some commonly accepted civil values and to add expressive nuances to it, like regret. Whenever we transgress commonly accepted societal mores and values, it's from these mores that we learn to express such emotions as regret through expressive language and its atavistic antecedents of language, gesture, facial expression, and mime, supported by grunts and groans. And if you've ever travelled to a land where English is not spoken, a language that you can't understand, all the expressions and gestures that we might use when we're well and truly outside our comfort zone. Hands up if you've had that experience, yes. So we rely on gesture, facial expression, to be understood. Regret is a feeling, sometimes without foundation, that we've somehow fallen short of what we might have hoped to achieve. Failures, personal regrets, faith, belief, values that we don't live up to, fall short on, relationships strained, as in the sonnet, opportunities missed. As our social groups got bigger, rules and laws became necessary for our survival. Some of these more essential rules and laws were formalized as religions, giving them divine authority, transcending the merely human authority. Laws writ by the hand of the Almighty. There was the threat of heaven and hell and damnation for those who disobeyed. This ensured social stability. A priesthood, male or female, or both, was created to act as intermediaries linking ordinary folk to the divine, and in the process gaining power for themselves and the institutions they represented. Such a religious framework of essential values and laws regulating our conduct helped us to distinguish the many nuances between innocence and guilt, love and lust, nurture and neglect, interest and apathy or disinterest. Xenodochia, hospitality that is, or xenophobia, restraint and free will. Religious belief was essential for us to get where we are today, to be successful as a species. But we now need new values if we're to survive for much longer. And for that to happen, we need a politically stable and biodiverse planet with much greater equity than we've got now. So how might this atavistic, primitive response evolve into values and mores that form part of a moral framework? It's most likely the product of lessons learned by our early ancestors, lessons learned the hard way. I'll use the example of hospitality, which will hover somewhere between the extremes of xenodochia, extreme hospitality, or xenophobia, paranoia, fear and mistrust of strangers. Hospitality is very important when we find ourselves in strange and new lands amongst people who don't speak English, or our hospitality to strangers who may be finding their way in our land. A month ago, my wife Faye and I went to a recent Iranian poetry reading at the Burnside Library on the Kurdish New Year's Eve, Nowruz, celebrated near the autumnal equinox, aligning happily with Ramadan. We found ourselves amongst Iranian Kurdish poets and poetry lovers, listening to Iranian poetry recited passionately in Farsi, but not English. Some poems had printed translations, but there wasn't enough English translation for one Anglo-Australian lady. Strong on self-assertion, she protested that she felt excluded from the evening. But I had a glimpse. I had a glimpse of what it must be like to be alone in a country without the command of the dominant language. Our country is so overwhelmingly monolinguistically English. I wondered how they judged Australian hospitality when so many of them have been incarcerated as refugees and yet had so much to offer us. This was a momentary regret, a felt shortcoming of our lucky country. So what about hospitality? Well, the most hospitable people in the world are the Malazori Highlanders of beautiful Albania. Who's been there? Anyone been to Albania? Not exactly high on the list of tourism destinations. Why? Why are they so xenodochial, so hospitable, sacrificially so? Hospitality on steroids. The reason will be found in their history of blood feuds that have spanned many generations of Malazori. What has driven this hospitality is hakmara, an obligatory blood feud which requires one to commit murder in order to salvage the honour lost by a previous murder or humiliation of some sort. The hakmara, revenge, is the social obligation to kill an offender or a member of their family in order to salvage one's family honour. The rules are found in the Canon of Lek Dukajini, a collection of traditional customs, cultural practices and laws that regulated Albanian lives between 1400 to the 21st century. The canon forbids the revenge killing of children, women and the elderly, and it also lays down alternatives to revenge killing to resolve a blood feud, such as the payment of compensation. But when these alternative resolutions fail, a blood feud results. And these blood feuds have torn families apart and isolated individuals for centuries. Even today, 3,000 or so Albanian families are still plagued by ongoing hakmara, with the old scores still to settle. If a traveller is murdered, unlikely, as Albania is especially safe for that very reason, the traveller's host will be obliged to avenge his or her death. Hospitality, therefore, is a time-honoured way in the Albanian canon of staying out of trouble. It is common to be blessed with the following words as you are welcomed or bid farewell to a host. They will say, "Blessed are the feet that carried you to our door, and blessed is your hand that knocked on it." To give offence might trigger a blood feud, a matter for considerable regret. And so we have Albanian hospitality supercharged, perhaps even exaggerated by our standards. But just in case there's any misunderstanding, hospitality has spread from the Malazori Highlanders to the rest of Albania. Albanians honour a traditional code within the canon called the Beza, which translates to keeping the promise. Observing Beza involves preserving family honour and hospitality, the recipe for a successful life. Lurking there in the background is the atavistic fear of a blood feud should we offend someone. Many Albanians have since left for better material lives in other European countries like Sweden, taking their canon and their Beza rules with them. They will regret that the old ways of the canon will be found wanting or unnecessary in Sweden, but it provides a good example of how a belief institutionalised and socially constructed in its traditional setting is deinstitutionalised, deconstructed in a new setting, as Albanians adapt to new ways, new mores, new social expectations. There'll be regret for the passing of some of these old ways, but there will no longer be the fear of hakmara. But it's not all that long ago that Western Europeans had similar blood feuds that our legal systems and modern policing have mercifully replaced. Well, almost. I think of the revenge killings and payback of the biker gangs at the present time. Blood feuds. I now come to some reflections on Anzac Day. Mine is not a traditional approach to Anzac Day. I would like to reflect briefly on warfare and the lifelong social, economic, and psychological costs of war as one of our principal regrets. We share so much in our common humanity with the people we might believe to be our enemies, our differences often exaggerated by our respective propaganda machines. And so often, the real warmongers are the ones who didn't have to fight, so often the old and powerful. Or they sell weapons or other resources needed to fight, or they may materially benefit in other ways. I was born in the middle of World War II, 1942. I've benefited from being born amidst a war that members of my family helped to win. My life would have been very different had we lost that war, and I thank them. But I also remember the regret of my 99-year-old Uncle Ted, who died last year, the last man standing of his regiment. At a time of relative peace, he saw former enemies become Australia's trading partners and allies against new enemies who were once our allies. Both my maternal uncles, brothers Ted and Fred, served, one still in his teens in New Guinea and in the islands, now forming part of the Indonesian and Malaysian archipelago. As did my other uncle, Uncle David, my first employer in a carpet shop, in another regiment, who also died last year shortly after his 100th birthday. David went on to build all the large towns in the northwest of Western Australia. He was a project manager of a very large urban construction firm. Like the Malazuri blood feud or Hakmara, a war so often becomes a festering sore and a trigger for more wars. The 100 Years' War before England and France from 1337 to 1453, 116 years of war, ending in the Battle of Castillon, eventually won by France. Or was it the English who won by deciding that it had to end? Give peace a chance, they thought. But they were at it again only 43 years later. And long after that, another warrior, Napoleon, decided he would like to conquer the rest of Europe and Russia. War, like love, is a never-ending story. It is soon to be remembered again on Anzac Day. Regrettably, it's the young who pay the price for our international blood feuds. All that still to be realised human potential, sacrificed, wasted, with the residue of guilt and regret from the horrors of combat expressed in lingering post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide. In a world where some of the trauma of war is captured more graphically than ever before on devices as accessible as our mobile phones, we homo not so sapiens are growing war weary. Several generations ago, young men of so-called fighting age thought that war would be a bit of an adventure, a chance to travel at the government's expense, see the world, and perhaps kill people. We can now see it in all its horror nightly, on our televisions, on our devices. We're also becoming more aware of alternatives to warfare. imaginative pathways to the peaceful resolution of conflict, working towards greater global equity, fighting the real war of global environmental sustainability, living within the capacity of our planet to provide for us the human plague, rather than squabbling over dwindling resources. And yet we still see global saber-rattling, a call to arms, most often by those who know they won't ever have to do any fighting. Sadly, nature, in response to global inequity, fear and poor governance, produces a warrior class, hell-bent on fighting. We have them here, we see them over there. And once again, as Anzac Day approaches, some of our media beat the war drums to sell more newspapers. And others, who also stand to gain from war, are at it again, that old paranoia in danger of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. War produces no winners, and with mad, mutually assured destruction, nuclear war, there will be no winners in any world war of the future. But, one might argue, war also spurs on new inventions, new technologies, in our case other people's, atomic power, submarines, and the opportunity to end our global blood feuds with mutually assured destruction, self-annihilation, perhaps putting quantum physics aside. That's why we've never been visited by aliens. They kill themselves off before they actually get to the stage of intergalactic travel, if it's at all possible, which I doubt. I'll conclude with two very different poems. I'm drawn to a war poem by Wilfred Owen. It's about a lad filled with the thrall of warfare and weaponry, aspiring to serve his country. We call it duty, patriotism, sacrifice. It's killing, so often sanctioned, even by churches, I hope never by ours. It is all these things, but at what cost? Death in the trauma of combat is no easy gateway to heaven and to eternity. What loss of human potential, all in fulfilment of that old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. Another of Wilfred Owen's poems, and perhaps his best known. Sweet and fitting it is to die for one's country. This Shropshire lad, friend of Sigrid Sassoon, both shown here, were both gay, and they were both lovers. Owen lived for a while in France, returning home in 2015 to enlist in the Artist Regiment, and then sent back to fight as a lieutenant in the Lancashire Fusiliers. He served with distinction, but suffered PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, shell shock as it was then called. He was hospitalised for it, treated, and returned to the front line, and shortly after was killed in action at 25, just 1 week before the 1918 armistice. His lesser-known poem, Arms and the Boy, is, I think, his most poignant, borrowing the idea from a title of George Bernard Shaw's light comedy about the stupidity of soldiers and war, Arms and the Man. The enduring image is as a young World War I recruit, after being freshly kitted out with bayonet, blunt bullets, projectiles and cartridge shells of zinc, is enthralled by the power he now has to kill, but like many young men, not really understanding what death really is. Let the boy try along this bayonet blade, how cold steel is, and keen with the hunger of blood, blue with all malice like a madman's flash, and thinly drawn with famishing for flesh. Lend him to stroke these blind, blunt bullet leads, which long to nuzzle in the hearts of lads, or give him cartridges of fine zinc teeth, sharp with the sharpness of grief and death. For his teeth seem for laughing round an apple, there lurk no claws behind his fingers supple. And God will grow no talons at his heels, nor antlers through the thickness of his curls. Arms on the Boy is about young human potential lost in wartime, a contrast between what is and what might have been. It is a poem of war and regret. Combat medics throughout history of warfare report that a soldier's last dying words, whatever side he was fighting on, were an anguished call by a son to his mother, or for an older soldier to a loved one. I can see why one of our own, George Hale, the minister at our Wakefield Street Church at the outbreak of World War II, was a pacifist. Regrettably, his pacifism split the congregation, many families, having just seen their sons called up to fight and regretting it, wanted George gone. And regrettably, he went to Melbourne, to his fame and to Melbourne's gain. After the war, he did return to his beloved church, no longer as minister, but a member who continued to give frequent addresses. Are we Homo sapiens smart enough to repress our warrior instincts in the interests of global equity and sustainability? Our planet can no longer withstand the insult of war. It is one of my regrets that provocation, though, can so easily pierce the thin armour at my Achilles heel. Now, by way of contrast to Wilfred Owen's Arms and the Boy, I'd like to read this poem, which Mary published in our February-March newsletter. It's written by an American poet, Nicolette Sauder, about much younger children than the young man in Arms and the Boy. I hope you read it. Who can remember it? No? It's the very antithesis of Arms and the Boy, and I hope it will be an appropriate positive finale to this somewhat depressing topic of regret. It's all about future potential and promise, about raising children into the thrall and joy of nature. Human potential directed in peace towards caring and nurturing the little wild things that are so important to the rest of nature, part of the web of which we are a part, but also caring for the voiceless amongst us. It's a poem full of promise, of hope and love, of nature and nurture, hope of human potential fully realised, the very opposite of regret, the very opposite of war. It has all of regret's antonyms: delight in, discovery, happiness, contentment, pleasure, joy, praise in the natural world. May we raise children who love the unloved things, the dandelion, the worms and spiderlings, children who sense the rose needs the thorn, and run into rain-swept days the same way as they turn towards sun. And when they're grown and someone has to speak for those who have no voice, may they draw upon that wilder bond, those days of tending tender things, and be the ones. So, let's banish regret and try hard to live our lives by our shared Unitarian wisdoms, thus still evolving, as next week's address will consider, as are all wisdoms, and so they should be. For when wisdoms no longer grow, the end of growth is marked by atrophy and decay. These wisdoms have been born out of our past mistakes, our regrets, our hopes for something better, and the willpower to bring about change. So let's live our wisdoms proactively. We will at the very least have replaced our regrets with hope, and hope leads to action. And as hope is infectious, so will it spread. So may it be.
We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.